Okay, we're back. I think this is episode 68, if I got my count correct, of Powers and Principalities.
Yeah, 68.
68. Okay, so, well, tonight we wanted to talk about, I think we agreed to talk about race mixing, particularly in media, popular culture, in advertisements, marketing, TV, movies, even music, and why this has become such a hot trend lately. Why is it being so promoted, particularly black-white? Obviously, race mixing, that's the least common, yet it's being promoted as, you know, it's most promoted on television. It occurs far more often in movies and entertainment and in commercial than it does in actual life. So why, indeed, is it being promoted? I mean, if a person were to come down in the United States, and he would think that almost like every other relationship is a mixed race, particularly black on white. Of course, the most common race coupling is white on Hispanic. That has a lot of historical precedent for the United States. That goes back to the conquistadors in Spain and the mestizos and these things. White and Hispanic. Then after that, there's white and Asian. I think white and Hispanic constitutes 43% of all race mixed couples. White and Asian is 14.4%, and other mixes is 30.4%. White on black is only just under 12%, 11.9%. Yet it's the least common, it's the most common portrayed in the media. Let me just cite some statistics here to start a discussion. Intermarriage rates by race and ethnicity, whites marry outside their race 9.4%. Black 17.1%, Hispanic 25.7%, Asians 27.7%. So whites are the least likely to marry outside their race. That's understandable because they're the majority, you know, almost 70% of the population still. So they're most likely, more of them out there. Whereas if you're in a minority, there's less of them out there. And so, you know, less of your group out there. So that's just going to break down that way. Income by couple. Asian whites have the highest income, $71,800 a year. White Asian, this is husband and wife. So husband and wife, Asian husband, white wife, 71.8%. Asian is $62,000 per year. White Hispanic is almost $61,000 a year. White and black is $60,700 a year. White it stands at $60,000 a year. The poorest is Hispanic on Hispanic. That's $35,000 a year. Just above that is our black on black couples, almost $48,000 a year is the national average. And this is where it gets interesting, is where it becomes problematic. The divorce rate is 200% higher for white women who marry outside their race. So it's a much higher risk rate for women who marry outside the race for divorce. 2016 report on sexually transmitted diseases. Blacks have the highest rate of have the highest infection rate. Here's what's really disturbing. This is what's maybe a problem here. 70% of black children, of course, are born out of wedlock, and 92% of biracial children are with black fathers are born out of wedlock. 82% are on welfare. Only 10% of white women who have children with black men ever marry. The vast majority of white women who have children with black men are below the poverty line. Interracial couples experience much higher rates of domestic violence. This is where the change culturally. 1958, only 4% of whites approved of black or white marriage. By 2007, 75% claim to approve. A lot of that, they believe, is people who, when they take these questionnaires or surveys, aren't willing to say they disapprove. So there's a lot of social desirability or bias in the answers, perhaps. 2010, this is where it gets interesting. 69% in a Pew Research Center study in 2010 said they disapprove of single women who have children. Basically, they're against single, women having single women having children. 43% said unmarried couples who raise children is a bad idea, but only 14% were against interracial marriage. Now, this is interesting because the logical result of interracial marriage is a much higher rates of illegitimacy, out of wedlock birth, and never married. Yet people are still afraid to admit they're against it. Now, this is the logical outcome of interracial marriage: is higher rates of divorce, higher rates of illegitimacy. Yet, now we have 80 to 85% of people asked said they approve of interracial relationships. So those are the stats breakdown. Basically, if you're a white woman who marries, you're more likely to live in poverty, be infected with STD, suffer domestic abuse, and also have children that are more likely to be born out of wedlock and suffer all the other problems associated with that. So why is it being promoted when it's in our society today? That's the question I ask. Yeah.
Oh, man, that sounds like the worst blind date in history. You know? I mean, what else can go wrong? Races have mixed, throughout history.
Yes.
Anglo-Saxon, as yes. example, but the race mixing that is historical is basically voluntary. There are examples, though, where race mixing is part of military conquest, right?
Raping and pillaging.
Yeah, raping and pillaging. As, for example, the Russians did in Germany at the end of World War II.
Yeah, urged on by Ilya Ehrenberg, the Soviet propagandist.
Exactly right. Yeah. So, race mixing can be weaponized, and so what I think we often see, when we see the media promotion of interracial marriage, interracial coupling, is a weapon. It has been weaponized. It's very, very difficult and tricky to kind of parse out the weapon from the voluntary sort of activity and the news recording of it, mm-hmm. because there's a sound that sounds like a printer or something. Can you hear me?
I got you.
Okay, sorry. I thought you were taking off. You're not in a jet, are
you? Yeah, something. I got to adjust my microphone. It's getting too sensitive.
Wait. That just scared. Anyway, so what I was going to say is that look.
I think my three-year-old son was playing with my microphone.
Well, that's good. I love little mischievous.
I had it perfectly adjusted.
So you can, the question is the promotion of mixed race marriage that we're seeing and just absolutely around the clock. It just seems every single thing that you see in the media is a promotion of mixed race, and it's typically black and white. That would be by far the most common one. I just, before I came here, I was looking at television and they had a commercial where a black woman and a white woman are in a grocery store and the white woman says to the black woman, "Come over to my house. We're going to have a swingers party." And so then it's be there at 8 o'clock, and then they come and they say, "Yeah, it's Swinging," which is a new television network. It's sort of like I think it's in a part of Cox TV. I don't know, but it's some television promotion. And then the black couple are disappointed because they thought it was going to be a sexual swinging party. Now, I mean, this is like an ad that is on television without any restraint. I mean, kids could be watching it. I don't watch any, kind of TV that isn't just Netflix and Apple TV, right?
Yeah, my so, my kind of exposure to this is usually I'm at someone's house watching a football game.
Yeah.
You know, or like in the run-up to this, I watched a bunch of example ads that they have now streaming on YouTube, you know.
You can watch. Yeah, and so when you look at something like that, you have to think, well, is the person producing the thing a complete moron and just doesn't realize that he's promoting sexual degeneracy, or are we looking at something else, you know? And given the history that we have with the owners of the media in this country, I would say that for sure you're looking at something that's been weaponized. So in that particular case, they're getting both it's a twofer. They're getting both the idea that it's just normalized, interracial coupling is you know, here it is, and they're also getting moral degeneracy all the way around, because you know they're the black couple are there expecting, you know, to be swinging with the white couples. There's like three white couples and this one black couple on TV. So you have that, and then you have stuff like Quentin Tarantino, Pulp Fiction, mm-hmm. where he has a lot of interracial couples, black and white, but he does it without any comment. In other words, just puts them out there, and they don't make any kind of they don't mention at all that there's a interracial aspect to the relationship. It's just presented to the audience, and obviously this is neurolinguistic programming, to use an expression, because when you see this kind of a coupling and it's presented without comment, then it's obviously being normalized, right? And so. So I think that it's just beyond a doubt that we are experiencing basically weaponized propaganda that promotes race mixing. I think it's just, you know, I don't even think that people in the media would deny it. They might say, well, of course we're doing it, but we're doing it because it's a good idea. You know, they would say, well, it's helping to get a more multicultural. You know, they take the cultural Marxist position morally and just criticize you if you ask what the hell they were doing. But you have to always ask, you know, well, has it been weaponized? And what was the point of creating such a weapon? And I would point out the obvious, that if you are intent on destroying an ethnicity or a race, the final blow is basically to take whatever remnants there are and just breed them out of existence, right? Merge them with other groups. And then you would have a new race, you know. I would also note that from the perspective of the oligarchs, this is a great thing, because the mixed race would not have the problem of ethnicity, which, of course, to the oligarchs has always been an issue. Look at, how the Catholic neighborhoods were attacked after World War II. So the thing is that the American people, European people should start to have a reaction against the weaponized race mixing propaganda. They should demand an explanation, and they should be accusing the people who are presenting it of it coming from the wrong place in the heart. Because, you know, like here's the problem, is that you have a lot of mixed race people now. If you look at the U.S. Tennis Open, there's a Japanese African-American woman, Osaka. She's playing. She's half black. There's Madison Keys, who I think is half black and half white. So you have a lot of these individuals now. Now, if you bring forward the position that this has been a weapon for the, you know, which with the idea of destroying one ethnicity, creating a hybrid that can be easily enslaved, how do you bring that argument to someone who is of a mixed race background?
Yeah, because you're saying there's somehow deficient or problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Which of course isn't the case, but that's, yeah.
No, you mean that's a completely separate issue.
Yeah.
But my question is, well, how do you do it? How do you actually go to someone who is mixed race and say, well, you know, I'd like to explain that you have come into existence because there was an attempt to create basically a hybrid people that would be easy to control, which is you.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same problem that you would have if you go to like a gay man and you say, I really want to talk to you about the creation of homosexual activity, homosexual culture as a way to enslave people. You see, the problem is that their very being is now a bulwark against rational discussion. Because if you started to have this discussion publicly, the first thing that would happen is they would bring forward the mixed race people to give testimony about, you know, how bad it made them feel. You'd have The Rock threatening to beat you up, Vin Diesel trying to drag race you, and yes. So they
bring out these mixed race
alpha males, course, you know, and yeah. your heart would go out to them. Obviously, because I do think that they are the result of you know, the process I described. I think it's self-evident. But what the hell can you do? Because if you shy away from the truth because it makes people uncomfortable, then, well, what good is the truth? The fact is that the statistics you gave, which I made that bad joke saying it sounded like the worst, you know, blind date in history. I mean, the thing is, the statistics are really clear. That it wasn't a good idea to start this process from the position of who would be created by it. When you look at those statistics, they're so grim that you can see that the couples themselves were disadvantaged by the joining. And obviously the children, I mean, the 92%, I think, was the statistic mm-hmm. of like white, black kids that are of that coupling are born out of wedlock. Well, that can't be right. I mean,
I know three white women who've had children by black men, none of whom are married, none mm-hmm. of whom are supported by the father.
Right.
It's right out of the ghetto.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a tragic situation. Yeah. And so here we are. We've seen, Look Who's Coming to Dinner. You know, we've seen Sidney Poitier and
the doctor.
You know, I mean, yeah. And then it's so unreasonable to be opposed to this kind. And it's also you're in opposition to love. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here they are. These kids are Sidney Poitier. He's so polite and, you know, and kind of nice looking in his suits and whatnot. So they're in love. And are you really going to stand against love? And then if they have a child, are you really going to stand against a human being mm-hmm. who is, you know, with sensitivities and things? So you can only talk in broad strokes because these specific elements that have been produced by the attack are just so painful that it makes it, you know, rational discussion difficult. But at the same time, the catastrophic statistics that you were bringing up make it completely transparent to me that we really do need to, you know, as a people, to use an expression, bring out the idea that, wait a second, is this just like feminism and psychedelic drugs and, the Hollywood movies? Is this just another weapon against the people that is being developed? Because like we were saying, If you're basically in the business of say you have an oath to destroy, you know, a race of people, say you have something like that in your background, this is the last blow, right? This is where you can really evaporate them. So you have to at least be open to the possibility that since the statistics of these couplings are so grim, that there's something in back of it that's malevolent, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it just sort of sits out there and looks and it stares you right in the face. So that's where I'm at, Tim. I think it is weaponized. I think the statistics now are just like, you know, feminism are you know, in the pornographic male. I mean, the statistics are too clear to overlook that this was a bad idea. The races were not really prepared to mix like the Anglos and the Saxons evidently were at some point. And so you have to start thinking about and looking for who is creating it. What is their motivation?
Yeah. Good. Yeah. It's interesting. I think it's interesting to point out that a lot of this appeal towards race mixing and not having any, concern for your ethnic background, the continuation of your ethnicity, is this appeal to individual liberty and autonomy, which is the old trick, right? Same with sexual freedom. Well, this is ethnic freedom. You can your genetic freedom. You have no obligation to your family, your lineage, to carrying on your bloodline, in these things. Since just intermixed, fine in these things. And the trick again is denying someone's identity, basic identity, which basically one is both ethnicity, then comes sex. Both of those are under assault with homosexuality and also race mixing. But another point is that a lot of this idea of race mixing comes on the heels of racial integration in the name of justice and these things. And we've discussed in the past how that was weaponized to destroy the ethnic neighborhoods, to change the country's demographics and its politics and its culture, to facilitate things like the sexual revolution that fundamentally changed the public morality and people's behavior, which lead to family breakdown and all the social pathologies that we're all seeing today, which is, you know, a lot of the confusion we're seeing today is because people are coming from broken homes. They have no community, even community support, because they live in racially, heterodox or diverse communities. But this is, particularly with, again, why is the black male white female coupling so heavily promoted when it's the least likely of all the race mixing couples in the United States? Well, because there's an agenda here, which is what we're alluding to. You break down ethnicity. It's easier to people lose their ethnicity, their identity, and they become sort of hapless, debt-burdened consumers. It's easy to promote sexual degeneracy. So you have sex and debt as a weapon to enslave the masses. This idea of promoting interracial relations with black men also usually comes with sexual degenerate behavior. I mentioned, all the women I know personally who've had white men who've had children with black men aren't married. They have dysfunctional, broken homes. They had, illicit, or they fornicate. Let's use an old-fashioned word. Have these children. Now, this goes way back. I mean, the promotion of jazz, which was promoted by Jewish promoters in the music industry. Jazz was used as a conduit to promote, degenerate, permissive behavior, drugs, and these things. Then you had rock and roll in the 50s and the 60s, the same thing. This is promoting a certain type of behavior. All the time, the term rock and roll, I believe, was an expression black jazz or blues musicians used when they wanted to meet up with white women. So the term itself. But even you have people like Norman Mailer, the white Negro, and Jack Kerouac, this idea of spade kicks, being liberated free like the Negro, to live this free life, free of sexual rules or restrictions. Well, the problem with that is this: while this can be tolerated on the margin, when it becomes common behavior, society breaks down. And these characters can be charming, and even to, race mixing in certain areas and certain percentages in certain areas of the country can be more common. It can be tolerated because it's like you said, it's voluntary, and most people tend to be open minded and fair about this stuff. No one's in the business telling people who they should fall in love with. But when you see the constant pounding in the media and commercials, there's an agenda that's there to humiliate and cuckold white males. This also comes with the other gender, which is portraying white males as stupid, nerdy, weak. And we see these commercials and these things. So the destruction of masculinity, white masculinity, and the promotion of idea that white women should have children, or at least have sex, which is a product children with black men. Well, you produce a lot of women who look at the stats, don't have families, don't have fathers to support them. Where do they go? They go to the state. So you have women, more women who are dependent on the state than their children depend on the state. Well, that's a perfect recipe for tyranny. If you want to rule over a people, easier to govern. And like I said, a lot of this promotion, it's undeniable. What comes with it, this isn't Sidney Poitier and Tuesday Weld. Right, this is Snoop Doggy Dog or something, and like character, and they want to get down with you, and then they're Rolling Stones, as the Temptations said, they're never around, they're not supporting families, so this is a recipe for a disaster. But it's a disaster that certain groups want, because it creates a weaker society, a mongrelized society, as Codenov Kalirgi said. That's their words, by the way, miscegenation and mongrelized, because you destroy that ethnicity, and you destroy identity. And you destroy the means by which an individual has corporate representation that they can use as defense against the naked corporate state. or whatever oligarchy rules that state. And that's what they're destroying. That's what people don't see. This is the consequence of these things. And of course, if you try to voice opposition to this agenda, they'll accuse you of being a racist, which I'm sure many will after they hear this, because they have been programmed to think this way. If you like ethnicity, at some point you're going to have to say, you have to exclude people from your gene pool to preserve that ethnicity. If you like Italian food, you're going to have Italians. Theoretically, you can have a German cook a great Italian food, but let's tell you what, in the end of the day, the final analysis, you're not going to have a genuine ethnic food without those ethnics around to make the food. And so there's a lot of cultural implications of these things that people aren't really considering when they just want to assume that, you know, we can all just be part of this diverse matrix or, you know, of different races. The only problem is the final analysis, they're destroying all real diversity, making everyone the same in the name of diversity. You know, and you've seen the agenda in Europe. I mean, obviously we've talked about Sweden and really those states, Norway, Sweden, these countries are being assaulted because they're the most white. And so now they're being inundated with migrants or immigrants, whatever, refugees, if you want to call them that. And of course we, I believe it's in Sweden with Barbara Lerner Specter, who started a group called, I think it's Padilla, and it's a Jewish organization. She's dedicated to destroying the ethnic states of Europe. And she says, Europe, this is a bygone era. It's going to have to end. And Jews are at the forefront of it. And because of that, there's going to be increased anti-Semitism. That's what she said. You know, and so what they're saying is, so they admit to it, you criticize them for it, and this is the old trick. Then you're the anti-Semite when you point out the very behavior that they brag about. And there are Jewish organizations dedicated, not to mention the fact that a lot of the ads that we all see, they're, I believe, marketing industry is about as concentrated as mainstream media or entertainment. There's four major companies that dominate the market, and they're all Jewish owned, and they're promoting this agenda. So they set this agenda. So when you're watching these commercials and you think, is there an agenda here? No, they couldn't be coordinated. There's four companies owned by a handful of people, and they all have an agenda. And if they're like Mrs. Specter, then that's a problem, because they're dedicated to this idea. This is they're a dedicated idea of pluralism. I guess theoretically, because a pluralistic society without any ethnic identity is a weaker society. And as the ADL said, diversity is our strength. So,
yeah. Well, I wanted to get back to that idea that promotion of black male white woman sexual coupling was part of you listed a number of things, you know, where you have the white male is nerdy and incompetent. He's basically in the media, you know, just over and over again, you mm-hmm. see him as someone who is not basically you know, sort of a person with authority and you know, someone who could function as a father, you know, someone who has dignity. I mean, I don't know when was the last time I saw a character like that. They just don't produce it. They have sexually degenerate characters or anti-heroes, mm-hmm. you know, and then they have sitcom white males. If they're not homosexual, they're you know, basically the butt of all the jokes because they're stupid. And then in the mix of that, you also have black male, white woman sexual coupling, and rarely the reverse. Rarely is it black woman, white male, though I have seen a few of these, but by and large, it's the other way. And I would just suggest it's as obvious neurolinguistic programming. And the idea is that, the white male is to see himself as impotent, that, you know, in ethnicity, one of its aspects is that the males basically are very protective of the females. Right. Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of a natural part of an ethnic group. And when the white women are basically coupling with, you know, with African-Americans, then the message that is being, you know, put is to the white male is that you're impotent. And this, of course, is part of the political impotence, because if you look at the politics in America, you know, I mean, well, like we had Obama as a president, but you also have the onset of, you know, very aggressive feminist politicians. And there, of course, is just a general cultural Marxism on the campuses. So the white male is basically being given clues and psychological structures, you know, that he doesn't have any power. And so then you can simply accept, you know, a lack of any participation in the political process. I think that's kind of one of the things that is in back of it, is that it's just a way to condition white males into seeing themselves as impotent in terms of culture. So they don't participate in politics. You know, I mean, it's just in my neck of the woods, you have the Democrats are in control, but you just don't see a white male typically anywhere. That is sort of, kind of what you'd think of as a normal guy. I went to a political forum. I was curious about it. They had like a couple Latino ladies, and they had one white male. He was sitting there at this bench, and they had their occupations in front of them. And the white male, the occupation was homemaker. I'm not kidding. So I said, well, I'm not sure this is the guy I think that's going to like lead the rebellion, you know? And so, this is another example, Tim. You are affected by the culture all the time. This stuff when you see it, it's in every movie, it's in all of the television, it's in the newspapers. It's even in the streets now, you know, because there's enough mixed race couples that they will be visible. And no one is bringing up the idea that this is the result of malevolence and was weaponized. It was weaponized race mixing, just like weaponized feminism, you know? And so, it goes to the sense of intimidation. I mean, next week we'll have 9/11, another anniversary. And, you look at the statistics that 50% of the population don't buy the government story, and yet the media produces 0% of the media coverage with the idea that the government story is not true. Mm-hmm. So why is that okay? Well, it's because there is this sense of intimidation, and the way to break it, the way to rebel, is to bring up the subjects. With race mixing, it's a touchy one. You know, I think 9/11 is probably, you know, less on the kind of potential explosive reaction sort of topics, but it is something that we just have to bring up, because when you look at the immigration policies in European nations, they are so economically incoherent and culturally destructive, just self-evidently self-culturally destructive, that you just have to bring this up as it's deliberate, it's malevolent. You have to start having that idea being brought to the public. It never is. The media is not going to do this. It's up to shows like ours and to the people who listen to them, right? If you get it, if you can say, you know, this is just absolutely clear cut. You know, I hate to say it, but what we're presenting to them is the requirement of courage. You know, you just have to be courageous. And it's like we've said before in other shows. Look, if they were going to take us to a pleasant world, right, where violence was reduced and there would be, you know, that would be okay. I would say I'd prefer, you know, there should be some voluntarism and we should want to do this. It shouldn't just be a small group, but at least you could make the case like it's not completely malevolent. But in this case, the group that's going to be created is just basically going to be the deltas and epsilons of A Brave New World. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to be one step ahead of the autistic, but they're just going to be nothing but sex slaves and, you know, and cabana boys. I mean, there is just nothing for them in The Brave New World. They're not being created to be and have any relationship to the technology altogether. You want to know what's really what their future is? Look at all of the post-electric shows that are on. You know, you have Naked and Afraid, Dual Survivor. You know, all of these survivor shows. You know, they have this tragic, like this Alaskan bush family. Mm-hmm. You know, where everyone is out there trapping squirrels, you know, and things. And it's just, this is just obvious conditioning to prepare us, to prepare the new mixed race group for the world they're going to be living in. They're going to be living in a post-electric world. There'll be nothing but sex slaves, cabana boys, and, you know, and then they'll be probably made extinct very quickly after that. So, you know, if you're going to rebel, don't wait. Now's the time.
Yeah, and, you know, if society is shattered, you're easy to exploit. Just look at, like, a lot of the people coming out of Eastern Europe after the Balkan Wars in the 90s, which were fomented by NATO and the United States and the European powers, is a lot of those girls coming out of there became sex slaves. A lot of the boys too, and a lot of the boys turned to criminal enterprises and these things, or for cheap labor abroad and these things. So this is what happens. And so the same thing if your community is shattered and you're atomized in these things, and then you no longer have any other means of defense or support other than your employer, which is increasingly a corporation like Walmart or Amazon or something, you know. Then they can implement who then can very easily implement the agenda of the New World Order simply through terms and conditions and human resource policies. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a law per se. It's just sort of all these corporations agreeing on a certain culture. That's like the people out at Silicon Valley, or the people who run Amazon, or the people who run Target. They all agree sort of culturally on these things. They all meet perhaps at Bilderberg or something, and they coordinate policy. And this is why, if you look at all, you know, these, this is why you have this sort of the global homo agenda of the New World Order, and why whenever there's some country that's being destabilized or being liberated, you know, by NATO or the West, they're introducing abortion, gay rights, you know, transgenderism and these things, pornography. So that's part of the agenda. It's part of the enslavement. You're liberated sexually so you can be enslaved literally. One thing it is, if you talk about why this is being done, who is doing it, it's there's a few names of corporations that are behind it, and it's being, and you have to ask yourself why they all agree on it. Well, they come from a group that have a certain worldview. And that's what other explanation is there? Do you think that, you know, just by chance they all happen to agree?
There is no other explanation. It's so completely transparent. You'd have to wonder, well, why can't people see this? You have the basic problem is that you have cryptos. You have people who pretend to be Gentile, and this is really. I wanted to actually, and this would be a good time to just, if you don't mind, I'm just going to digress for just 2 minutes. Is that okay, Tim?
Digress away.
I was going to digress into, I was listening to a show that you had done with E. Michael Jones. And I mean, and you can see this is like a comment on my social life that I would actually, this is like, how I spend my spare time. And you and E. Michael were talking about Europe, and and Churchill came up, and Jones said that, well, the Jews had Churchill in their back pocket. He owed $80,000 to the Rothschild. The Jews had Churchill in their back pocket. And they had his father in the back pocket. Lord Randolph died owing the Rothschilds £80,000. That's what he said. It was in the 1 year last that you did. And this is just incorrect. Now, I don't ever like to cross swords with E. Michael, because he has not just an incredible amount of facts. And I would say, along with Dave McGowan, I think he's probably the most original scholar, you know, of the kind of alt media. I just think the world of his scholarship. But what he doesn't have is the understanding of the crypto, and he explains Churchill, the relationship between Churchill and the influential financial Jewish powers in Britain, because that they had this money control over him. And this is just completely incorrect. And I just wanted to demonstrate that. It takes like 2 minutes. I mean, first of all, Lord Randolph, Churchill's father, did not die owing the Rothschilds £80,000. In fact, he died, his estate was worth about £70,000. It became a trust that was beneficial to his wife and then to both Winston and his brother. It was the equivalent of around $2 million today. Now, 100% of this money had come from the Churchills and beat the other mining financier in South Africa, the other Jewish mining financier. What they did was, when Randolph was down here, down in South Africa, as an employee of the Rothschild family, basically, they were funding him. He couldn't find any gold. He was a complete disaster, as all of the money they gave him, he lost. They were trying to promote him, not enslave him. So when they found gold, Beat gave shares to Randolph at like pennies on the dollar. It was they had this mine that they found, which was a sure thing, basically, and it was called the Matchless, I believe. And so what happens is that it's called Deep Levels. Sorry. Anyway, so it'd be long-winded here. But anyway, so they gave it to Randolph, all these shares at pennies on the dollar. He bought in at the same price that the Rothschilds did. Beat and the Rothschild family are basically, it's like the Rothschild and the ships. They were banking families, interrelated. Okay, so they gave Randolph this money, and this was a promotion of Randolph, right? They promoted him to wealth, and it's important to understand that, because you can't understand Winston if you see him as someone who's in the pocket of the Jews. And I just want to mention that E. Michael also misses the fact that Churchill's mother was Jerome. Her father was the business partner of Rothschild's agent in the United States, Belmont. They own the New York Times, for heaven's sakes. So again, this is a connection that is not enslavement, it's promotion. And then if you look at Churchill's relationship to Zionism, the very earliest proto-Zionists were Churchill's. If you look at the Palestine Exploration Fund, that has the Queen and Charles Warren, all of the Quattro Coronati Freemasons. Churchill's uncle is one of the 10 people who are actually supporting this thing. So you have this long-standing family connection into promotion of Israel, Zionism, and a relationship to the Rothschild family that is financially beneficial. So my point is, sorry to be long-winded, but E. Michael should really think about the idea that Churchill is not someone who's in the pocket, because he wasn't. And when he ran out of money because he was such a spendthrift during his life, they gave him more and more money. But this was a continuation of the same thing that had been going on since Randolph was working for the Rothschilds, 30 years before he died. The idea is, why don't we look at some other explanation than this is just controlled by money? Why don't we look at the idea that a family as Masonic as the Churchill is part of some kind of secret society that represents crypto Judaism? that in some way these Masons have a relationship to Judaism that isn't disclosed. Because I'm telling you, that is something that explains the family relationship, the generational family relationship to the Rothschilds. It explains the multi-generational relationship into proto-Zionism, and it works as an explanation. There's a lot of explanatory power, and I'm just amazed that Jones wouldn't consider it, because particularly in the interview you did, he went immediately on in the next paragraph. He started talking about the secret societies, mm-hmm. and about how this was a real problem. Well, you know, you have to look at the two of them, and I just think that this is the reasonable position. And you see, if you look at say the media, you know, with the idea that, you know, well, like we've talked about Wilbur Hayes, mm-hmm. you know, but if you look at Hayes's background, he's a Mason, and you wonder why is he seemingly creating this production code, but at the same time he's going and he's talking about the dangers of Hollywood, and yet at the same time he's the one who's going around making sure that everyone is, you know, every small town has a theater. I just think that we have to kind of think a little more nimbly about this particular issue. And I know that it's hard to, because when it's like talking about, you know, the problems of mixed race, you know, because you become so vulnerable to the charges of anti-Semitism when you get into this field. And I'll just wanted to finish by saying, look, not accusing the Jewish people of this act. What I'm accusing is a secret society that uses ethnicity as part of how it stays secret. And one of the critical elements it has are cryptos, people who are actually inside the organization that present themselves as just everyday Christians. I mean, another example of the E. Michael Jones problem was William F. Buckley, where he was saying that, you know, Buckley's sort of conversion into neoconservatism and the support of Israel is probably brought about by, you know, the fact that he had Jewish funding for the National Observer. But the fact is, Buckley's father is one of the richest guys in the country and supported his son completely. He didn't have a need for it to go in anybody's pocket. Why don't we look in the idea that there's something that goes on in skull and bones, where Buckley, you know, was, you know, being trained. There's something in there that explains Buckley's conversion to, you know, this weird neoconservatism.
Yeah, it gets into maybe as far back as the Illuminati and Adam Weishaupt, who himself, I think, was came from a family of converted Jews.
Yeah, and he was trained by the Jesuits at a time when they were 100% converso. That the Jesuits were so much a converso, they're so much a Jewish organization that they were actually told to stop letting conversos into the organization because the Pope was worried about it. It's the only organization that ever had that sanction. And so, you know, now, I mean, the scholarship this isn't like a conspiracy theory. The routine scholarship on Jesuit now just takes a position that the original group was, they call it the Synagogue of Jews. Right. That was the title of a book that a Jesuit scholar, you know, came up with. He said, look, these guys are all converso. So, you know, this is the point, is that when you see the malevolence and the secrecy, you have to explain it somehow. And the way I do it, the way that I think, you know, you can have explanatory power, the way you can look at someone like Churchill, someone like William F. Buckley, is that. The weaponized racial mixing, right, that's going on, that the idea is that, you know, there is a society that has secrecy, right? You look at, you know, Bohemian Grove, Skull and Bones, et cetera, they have secrecy. You don't know really what these oaths are all about. A lot of them present themselves as Christians, but they always have this strange relationship into groups of Jews and into these secret societies. So, you know, we've got to find some explanation that has some explanatory power. And I think that the kind of looking at the world with the idea that we don't see the plot and the application against European culture, because many of the people who are bringing it to pass are cryptos. George Bush, you know, I mean, 9/11, which will the anniversary is next week. Skull and Bones, you know, what's so again, what's in that? What's inside those secret societies at the deep level?
Well, I mean, if you look at something like Freemasonry and its project, its support for indifferentism in terms of religion, latitudinarianism, this idea of bringing everything together, homogenizing everything, and that would seem to factor into this agenda of racial integration and also race mixing. And you know, if you like you've pointed out the connections between Freemasonry and Judaism, particularly outfits like ADL, B'nai B'rith, some of the things they've done throughout the past. The NAACP was founded by Jews or is run by Jews. This was the Anti-Defamation League was created in the wake of the Leo Frank trial. Of course, Leo Frank was head of B'nai B'rith down in Atlanta, Georgia, who was convicted of murdering and raping a little girl down there. And then when he was lynched, this kind of sparked the Jewish war against the South. And that's when they started using the issues of Jim Crow or racial integration or segregation to sort of carry out a regime change in the South. And you also have the same thing going on in the United States, in the North in the 60s, 50s and 60s, and when Martin Luther King, you know, had his fair share of Jewish handlers and these things, and he was used to go around and stir trouble up and also protest and then go into the North, of all places, where his mission was a failure in 1966 and went into Chicago. But he was funded, of course, that particular mission was funded by the Rockefellers, but although his immediate handler, I think, was that guy, what's his name? Not Levy.
Yeah, gosh, I can't remember. We talked about him in the show we did.
And same thing with the Black Panthers, their organization. They were, Stokely Carmichael and these things. The guy who wrote Soul on Ice.
Eldridge Cleaver.
Eldridge Cleaver. You know, most people think that was ghostwritten. You know, so a lot of this is they're gonna support these causes, these groups, and to stir trouble up. But they said behind that there's an alternative agenda, or not alternative agenda, but a secret agenda. And one is the smashing of ethnos and these things to create sort of homogenized society. And so again, you have the problem of appearing to defend, you know, Jim Crow, or appearing to defend, you know, racial discrimination and hatred, if you point out the secret agenda behind these things.
Right.
You know, exactly. So that's the, again, you point out the same thing, how if you point out the agenda behind supporting, you know, a black white race mixing, then they bring out someone who is part black, part white, and you say, what are you saying? This person somehow not as deficient as a human being? Well, no, that's not what we're saying. It's not the point. But nevertheless, it becomes a problem. But you mentioned off call that, you know, a good example is the role, you know, the movie that the Birth of a Nation.
Yeah,
and
absolutely,
it's ties to Freemasonry and Jews. So that's an interesting story. What exactly was the agenda behind that film? You know.
Well, I mean, first of all, D.W. Griffith was a Mason. He was buried, actually, or his funeral ceremony was at the Masonic Temple in Hollywood. And his pallbearers were Samuel Goldwyn and Louis B. Mayer. So the film Birth of a Nation was completely funded by Jews. This isn't something that's a secret. I mean, that's just the fact. I mean, I don't know how unusual this was. What I think is actually a little more unusual is the fact that the film prior to this was by D.W. Griffith was about Judith, the biblical Old Testament character, and the movie was her story of where she, you know, dances and pretends to be a kind of a belly dancer, dances for Nebuchadnezzar. when the Jews are in captivity, and then she cuts his head off. So this was the and it's an odd topic for someone who is purportedly a Gentile. And so then you have Birth of the Nation, and I will shock our listeners by claiming that I have a different way of understanding the film than has been understood before. I'm sort of almost like a style I have, I guess, unfortunately at this point. But
wasn't there a recent remake of that?
Yeah, I think I forget, like by Spike Lee. The film is seen as very racist, and I was looking at it, the reason I was looking at it is because I was curious as to how race mixing was treated, early in the 20th century, because this is the film that, has the scene where a black guy tries to have sex with a white woman. The woman then jumps off the cliff rather than, permit him to touch her. And then the Ku Klux Klan then, reaps vengeance upon her. The film is, in my opinion, well, the film is completely Masonic. I mean, it's, he was a Mason. The first thing I would say is that the story is about two families. The families are separated. The war separates them. And then at the end, they come back together, as Ku Klux Klan members. So you have the Camerons and the Stonemans. Okay. Now, the names are, in typology, and this is typology. The names are, they have some meaning. Well, Stonemans, I think, is kind of not hard to grasp, right? In typology, you can never be exactly the same, but stonemason, I think, is close enough here. So the Stonemans are the, right? But the other ones are the Camerons. And I think that a lot of people don't get that Cameron is actually planned Jew. The word means hook nose. Yeah, Cameron. So it's the hook nose and the stonemasons, and they're separate by a war, but then they get back together. The critical pieces of typology are when the woman is killed, the guy, they get her body, and he gets all the Klan's people around him, and he takes his dead sister's shawl, which was incidentally a Confederate flag, so it's the stars and all the Masonic stuff on it, and Cameron Hooknose, he dips the shawl in her blood, but he does the same thing to a small wooden cross, and he goes here. It's not a talkie, but you have the saying. He goes here. I raise the ancient symbol of an unconquered race of men, the fiery cross of old Scotland's hills. Right. So you have no, remember, this guy is like a full on Mason. He knows that the Red Cross is the Masonic symbol of the Knights Templar. And this is a very interesting statement, because he's saying the unconquered race of men, So, who is he? And like on the surface level, it's like just the white European guys, but they really wouldn't have as an ancient symbol the fiery cross of the Knights Templar, right? So this is, I would say, if you want my take on like the Christ that Masonry looks at, in Caesar's Messiah, talk about this, that the Jewish historian has, there's this parallel crucifixion scene, and that would be the Christ that Masons look at, is this guy that the Romans also, crucified. And so this would be their symbol. And then after that, the knights ride off to the blaring sounds of the Ride of the Valkyries. So they play Richard Wagner, which, of course, is about as Masonic as you can get. And then they come to the climax, and it says it has the two families united, And it says, the former enemies of North and South are united again in their common defense of their Aryan birthright. In 1915, and incidentally, Griffin is in communication with the Cliveden set. This is right back to the Quattro Coronati, to Helen Blavatsky. His wife is basically a member of that. Oh, and I just want to throw a little bonbon in because I think you'll get a kick out of this. So Griffin's father, he was the guy that the skull and bones handlers of Jefferson Davis at the end of the war turned Jefferson Davis over to. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah. So the skull and bones guy, they said, well, we need to have Jefferson protected. So they got Griffin's dad, and he was the one who actually had control over Jefferson Davis to protect him and make sure they could get him in this pseudo trial with the skull and bones guy couldn't let him off. So you can see that, you know, this is like Dave McGowan, you know, where you have generation, right? When you get this was a guy with a direct connection to the skull and bones, Griffin's father. You know, he's the one who was picked to, of all the people, to protect Jefferson Davis. And so, you know, I would just say it's typology, that this idea of like, well, who is the Aryan? Who is the Negro? You know, you have to kind of to understand the Cameron and Stoneman symbolism. The black people are everybody in the world that isn't inside their club. And the Aryans, the ones that Helen Blavatsky, you know, kind of alludes to, well, these would not be the real, you know, it would be a misunderstanding to think of European. It's broader. It's sort of like when you get into the proto-Zionism, they talk about, Disraeli talks a lot about Britain and Jews as a single race. You know, it's like there's this Anglo-Judaism
the New Jerusalem.
The New Jerusalem and the Queen, and it's all their Hebrews and things. So this is kind of what I would say. And then in the original version, it gets cut out actually, but this will knock you out. So at the end of the play, at the end of the movie, the Camerons, the Hooknose, and the Stonemason, the Freemasons, are reassembled. Everything is great. And they've got, of course, you know, the Ku Klux Klan have the knights, you know, this movie is what got people dressed up like, you know, like in the strange, you know, thing with the white caps and stuff. This is the movie. This came after the movie. Before that, the Ku Klux Klan was never dressed like that. This is where it all comes from. It's from the straight Masonic, you know, understanding. But anyway, at the end of the original Birth of a Nation, you have a gigantic image of Christ coming down from the heavens, a giant Jesus. It's the second coming, you see. So this is the broad stroke typology here of it looks like on one hand that Griffin is, you know, he's talking about Christian culture. But I don't think so. I think that there is kind of a typologic comedy that's inside the thing.
The Civil War itself, the so-called Civil War, helped forge the Freemasonic Empire that is the United States.
Exactly.
And when you fires say, of that the war.
Nation, yeah. What nation is he talking about?
Yeah. Where, remember, proper understanding of the United States is it was not a nation. It was a confederation of independent states.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was then promoted. One of the reasons why it became so popular is that Woodrow Wilson promoted it.
Of course, this is the entry. This is the run up to America's entry into the.
The Great War. And Griffin then went on and worked with the War is Good thing and made a film about what a great idea it was to kill Germans.
Yeah, and the whole idea of the melting pot that was first I think posited during America's entry into the First World War to sort of get all the different ethnic groups that, particularly in the North, that made up America. It was this various, you know, more or less various, different ethnic groupings throughout the cities who you need to forge an American identity to get them behind this war. And the First World War really set the stage for that. You know, Hollywood played a big role. First role at the time, Hollywood would play a role. With war bond drives and these things, with the silent film stars playing a role in that, and so, yeah, I mean, again, if you look at the American Civil War as sort of fomented by, you know, banking Freemasonic interests, which there's a lot of evidence for that. More or less funding both sides and stirring up trouble on both sides to get this war going, from the fires of war, would forge the American Empire, which later many of the many families would then transplant to the United States, use it sort of as the muscle for the New World Order once the British Empire was bankrupted by the two World Wars.
Yeah, after it had been drained, of all of its essence, then they came over here to take advantage of this group of people. I just wanted to throw in, this is 1915. The original book with the Klansman was written by Guy Dixon, huge Freemason, and he actually wrote, he was talking about the movie, and he goes, why it's so important, he goes, this picture made clear for the first time that a new universal language had been invented, a new process of reasoning by which will could be overwhelmed with conviction.
Hmm.
Right? Now, that's like pre-Bernays, where this guy is saying that this is a new language where reasoning can be overwhelmed, right? And then Griffin, when he talked about the film, he goes, the thing that's so great about it is that in the future, no one will have to read, because if they want to know what happened in history, they can actually just look at it in the film.
like Schindler's List or...
Schindler's List or Zero Dark Thirty, where you can...
Zero Dark Thirty. Or Inglourious Bastards.
I mean the pseudo history
roots.
The Birth of a Nation is really important book. I hope people actually start to study, because I do think that the Masonic typology and the crypto typology are very, very clear. I mean, this idea, why is the Knights Templar Red Cross of Freemasonry being represented? And no way Griffin was not aware, right, that, that this was a non-Christian symbol, right? Obviously, then the guy is a huge Mason. And so what is it? You see, what in the heck is it? And this... What happens with this movie is that this then inflames white males, and you have an enormous rise of this new Ku Klux Klan, right? Which is just at this point. See, there's two Ku Klux Klans. There's an actual one right after the war, and then in 1920, the second one came about
spread all the way into the north, like in Illinois.
Absolutely. And this was like there's no question. The first one was obviously, Masonic concoction, but it's hard to prove. But in this one, the individuals who started it are well known, and it's 100% Mason. So basically what you have is an aspect of Masonry that they're bringing to the public, which is, racially explosive. And this, of course, is going to lead to the rationale for, because you have the lynchings, all of this. Well, it's problem, reaction, solution, isn't it? And what is the solution? Well, it's the multicultural world.
Yeah, with harsh restrictions, centralized regulations in terms of anti-discrimination laws and these things, federal courts controlling schools to implement integration, destroying community-based education, these things. So the New World Order education agenda, Agenda 21, or outcomes-based education, or what's that latest one, that nonsense they have now, being implemented through the school systems, through corporations. But it is interesting that something like the Klan, which is now mostly FBI agents, infiltrators. The Klan, the American Nazi Party, these are actually agents of ADL, Brene Brith, through the Jewish Defense League and these things, and they fund these organizations so it gives them an excuse. They want to fund hate, these outrageous examples, in order to justify their existence in these things. And the ADL, ADL or the Southern Poverty Center, which is also Jewish run, you know, these are agents, or they work with the FBI and the federal government to shut down, to stifle alternative or opposition voices, critical voices. And also at the same time, they're promoting sort of this kooky theater of the Ku Klux Klan to create an image of hate to justify the existence. I was reading an article reviewing a book about the American First Committee. And even way back in 1940, the ADL was working with the FBI to harass and defame members of the American First Committee, one of the largest anti-war organizations that ever existed in this country. And the FBI, after Pearl Harbor, the FBI raided Henry Regrini's office and stole his mailing list that had like 850,000 names on it, and to destroy the organization. It was a loyal opposition, but it had to be destroyed because it was loyal opposition, genuine grassroots, and it was an opposition to the Anglo-American Zio Empire, which is dragging the country into yet another war. You know,
And
I don't know how it factors into race mixing, but this show is made for digression. So,
it was made for digression, but the fact is that when you look at Griffin as his connection into the Clevedon set, now you can finally see the whole purpose of
the British establishment.
Yeah, because
the Clevedon set is the one that Carol Quigley writes about in the Anglo-American establishment. They're the elite group in England who kind of intrigue Britain into war with Germany by playing both sides, sort of encouraging there's a certain pro-Hitler set and a anti-Hitler set within the Clevedon set, and that's there to, and what Carol Quigley suggests is that was just a ruse designed to provoke Hitler, who then...
Right, well, the point is that you have a complicated and concealed system by which Hitler is being created.
Yeah.
And these guys are playing a role, and you get Hitler, and now you have anti-Semitism, in this media character. You get the Holocaust, which we've talked about, the level of reality the thing has. But you have this, now you have anti-Semitism is just incredibly powerful charge you can levy against someone. The Holocaust is a whole moral structure. So you can see that this group, which was Masonic and also Jewish banking families, ended up by creating Hitler. Now you can also do things like firebomb Dresden and Hamburg, right? You couldn't do that without Hitler, but they created him. Now you have the justification. Well, when I saw Griffith's relationship into this group, I my eyebrows flew up in surprise, and I said, aha, so this is why he was trying to bring about a visual representation of a white woman being attempted rape by a black man. Because now you have the justification for the Ku Klux Klan that they created, which was just an element of cultural mischief that they were going to eventually have to fight against. If you think about it now, I mean, right today, you get David Duke being lampooned by Spike Lee. So the effect of creating a fictional racial struggle is still useful as a political tool, just in the same way that Hitler is still useful as a political tool and always will be.
The same way in the late 60s, black radicals, would talk about, screwing white women.
They would put that on. They would publicize those statements. And incidentally, I just wanted to mention in Birth of a Nation, Griffith lampoons black behavior. He has them as the most vile,
thieving, and sneaky. Yeah.
Well, they're drunk. They've taken over the political system. He completely transforms the actual history. There were carpetbaggers. There was a lot of power that was inappropriately given. But believe me, the behavior of the African Americans is not what Griffin was presenting. What he was doing you know, was lampoon, well, not just lampoon, he was using neuro-linguistic programming to make people, to create a certain image of the blacks that would then be useful to create the Ku Klux Klan. The film was really created just 100% by the Masons to create the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, there's just, it is a promotion piece for the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was then going to be an American version of Hitler, which could then be reacted against with more government, more multiculturalism. You know, the Europeans are bad, they're violent, they are racist, we need a multicultural government run by Ruth Bader Ginsburg in order to, like, bring sanity back to the planet.
Yeah. We need their oversight.
Yeah.
Because, like, yeah. Barbara Leonard Spector's, we have to be guided this way.
Otherwise, we'll just produce another Hitler.
Yeah.
Sorry. I mean, of course, we'll need Helen Blavatsky, Lord Palmerston and the Rothschild money to do it. But by God, we'll produce another Hitler. Mm-hmm. And who knows? We may even produce another, Ku Klux Klan if they ever let a Gentile in back of the camera in Hollywood again, except one that isn't a Freemason.
If you're against, white women having sex with, single white women having sex with single black men, and them making babies, and then those babies having illegitimacy rate of, 92%, and going on welfare and these things, well, then you're obviously a racist.
Yeah, that's racism to stand against that. See, it's just the cultures have been positioned, maneuvered into this activity.
Yeah.
100%.
And the media, so, I mean, you look at it, if celebrity, interracial couples are so important, why these things are promoted.
The Kardashians, I think, were created just for the purpose of showing how fun it is to have white women with black men.
Yeah, to normalize it, yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, what happens to the white male? Well, that's Bruce Jenner.
Yeah, and the funny thing about it is if you look at the statistics, is white women are the most resistant to having relationships with black men. But on television, it's the most prominent. At the same time, this creates a false expectation among black men who are watching the media. They're thinking, well, they must, white women like us. So when they go out and they're rejected at such a high rate, that just creates more embitterness.
Yeah, and it's just I ran into a racist, and then of course,
racist,
look, the cultures are just absolutely being maneuvered for violence, for hatred, and this activity, right? The response to this will justify, more government that they will then be able to just ratchet down the freedoms because, gosh darn it, you just turn your back and these Europeans will produce a Hitler.
This kind of goes back, and this is kind of funny because in a way your digression into I kind of led you into it, but when you're talking about the birth of a nation, I know because there is a strong message of miscegenation, the fear of so-called miscegenation and black rape. Although if you look in the United States, almost nearly 100% of all rapes to white women. Black-on-black-white rape, there's almost no white raping blacks. It's non-whites raping white women. So that's a grim statistical, a statistic that shows the reality of one element of crime in this country that should be addressed. And what does that say? But when you're saying watching Birth of a Nation, and he says that you don't have to read anymore or think, we can just get our idea of history just by watching movies. Well, you're relying on media to get your idea of reality, and that's a warning. The same way that people watch the Kardashians or watch commercials or TV, and somehow it's a warning that is, don't rely on that medium for what you think reality is. Turn the TV off. Don't let that affect you. Don't let Hollywood or Madison Avenue or Glamour magazine or whatever affect your idea of reality. That's a weapon. There are people producing that for a reason. And it's not just to sell things. Because if they were out to sell things, they would appeal to the way things people are. They're out to change you. There's not a chemical process going on here. And it's debasement. And that's what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly right. That's the thing. And then they've been able to be completely successful at dominating everyday conversation. There's so much an intimidation that people can't even express concern about these things that you're just, you look at those statistics, you go, my God, it's the worst blind date in history. How why would anyone ever promote this
thing? Well, it's incongruous because you're watching these commercials, they're ridiculous. I was watching this one ad, I think it was for like Audi. And it's an old grandfather on Christmas time or maybe Thanksgiving. And he's like somewhere up in Minnesota somewhere. And he's the whitest grandfather you ever see. He's like someone out of Minnesota. And it's bad weather. And he has the table set for a big, you know, party at his house. But it's bad weather. And he's convinced no one can make it. So he starts to put his silverware away. Sad music playing. And he starts to make like a microwave meal or something. And all of a sudden he sees all these lights rolling, and everyone's driving a certain Audi SUV that's so great it can get through any weather. That's the message of the commercial. But his children and his grandkids roll in, and half his grandchildren are half black.
Well, okay. You just have to let me read the quote, because the thing is, I want you to, when I read the quote from Griffith about, you know, like the future, I want you to think about Facebook and Google, okay? Here, this is what he wrote. He says, in 1916, he goes, imagine a public library of the near future, for instance. There will be a long row of boxes or pillars, properly classified and indexed, of course, and at each box, a push button, and before each box, a seat. Suppose you wish to read up on a certain episode of Napoleon's life. Instead of consulting all the authorities, wading through a host of books, and ending bewildered, confused at every point by conflicting opinions about what did happen, you will merely sit yourself at a properly adjusted window, press the button, and actually see what happened. 1916. Mm-hmm. Press the button and see what we want you to see. So that is an actual quote from Griffith. And this is, you know, whose father helped Jeb Davis make it to the Skull and Bones judge. And when he was buried, he had Samuel Golden and Louis B. Mayer at the Masons Temple in Hollywood to send him off to the promised land. So pretty clear to me, Tim. We really want to have a little sunshine put on the media in terms of what is in back of their the way and the system of culture production that they're engaged in.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
Hey, buddy. More than covered it. Yeah.
Okay, that Joe. Was
fun. Yeah, thank you.
Great. Enjoy your weekend.
Yeah, you too. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye. Bye.